we welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
Getting ready to talk the blues with you, but, you know, how can that be, Colin? How can you be so knowledgeable of the blues? I thought you were the Bruins guy or the Beatles guy or the Scrooge guy. You confuse people, Colin, by knowing so much about so many things. They can't handle the truth.
I know you're saying that in a joking way, and but unfortunately, it is a problem that I have yet to solve. And whoever sees or hears or reads whatever they do first, they tend to think that I'm that person, because you know what I really am, Kimball? I'm a strainer of credulity. It doesn't actually say that in the business card I don't have. But if I had one, maybe that would be a good thing to put there.
But it's one of the many things, and we've talked about it a number of times before, in the incredibly corrupt publishing industry. Well, there's corruption, and then there is just the stupidity, the lack of insight that goes with it, that it does strain credulity to some of these people, that you could know something about more than one subject because that's the world they live in.
Especially today, you know, and I was saying to a friend earlier this afternoon, I read these pieces, these nonfiction pieces, and they're essentially Wikipedia articles. Everything came from Wikipedia. They're just rephrasing what you can find on Wikipedia. And for a while, I would wonder how someone could do that, not just do it, but get away with it. There wasn't a problem that an editor wouldn't say, or a reader, what's going on here? I can just get this from Wikipedia. And then I realized, people now are so lazy, they don't go to Wikipedia directly. They almost count on that piece in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal as a courier, that it just happens to be containing. It's bringing Wikipedia. It's like, what's that, DoorDash or Drizzly for the people who don't want to get off the couch and they're like, where's my gin? And you just call up and it comes to you. It's really like that approach. So now you just have these factoids, and I experienced that with the Sam Cooke book, where sometimes people would complain because it wasn't just Wikipedia. And I thought, why would you have an entire book that's just saying You Send Me came out in 1957 when Wikipedia exists? And then I realized these people count on Wikipedia to sort of be brought to them via this intermediary. And it's like, no wonder we're so dumb. And so no wonder I come along and the first thing I pitch is about whatever, and they see these other pieces that I've written about whatever, and that's what I'm going to be to them. I'm going to get the trickle-down effect of someone else's limitations. And I think in time this will work itself out, but it's like I'm being punished for the shortcomings of other people, and that's a really hard thing to live with.
And then, you know, you explain that you write a tremendous amount of great fiction as well, and that blows their little minds.
And that's the thing, too, because that's really the majority of what I do. It's the bulk of my output. It's something like 450 short stories alone since early summer 2018, and most of my books are fiction, and it's what I believe that I'm here for, and everything is kind of an offshoot. I look at that as the ocean, and everything else for me are rivers, and rivers can be formidable and everything, but I'm not a riparian kind of guy. I'm an oceanic kind of guy. So it's all right there. It's all proven. It's more of an acceptance thing. And yesterday or recently, a new feature came out in Jazz Times in West Montgomery, and it's 2,500 words long. And if someone just read that, they would think that I devote my entire life to West Montgomery, that I'm just a West Montgomery scholar. So it's in that category of problems to be solved. But I never thought when I was starting out, and for a while as I was getting going, I never thought that this was an issue on the horizon. I never thought that this could be a problem. I thought the problem would be, is someone good enough? Can they be the best ever? I thought that ended up being the easier portions of it. It's it's like being in the desert and just being shackled, like in McTeague, to a dead body. And that dead body is the people of publishing. It's like, okay, how do I drag us out of here?
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Well, let's talk the blues. Well, let's listen to a little blues first, a taste of Magic Sam from West Side Soul. Magic Sam from West Side Soul, released in the late 60s. And boy, like so many of these blues men, Colin, he didn't have a long life. He died at the age of 32.
I just thinking about that today. These people were, for the most part, were not especially long for the world. And Magic Sam is an interesting figure, because I think when people think about the blues, they think it's going to be dark and dreary, and that's a great kind of blues too, that classic Mississippi Delta blues. But the blues isn't so much an emotional location as it is a style of music that can actually be quite up-tempo. It can be jumping and can be jiving. And I think what's cool about Magic Sam, for people who might not already be predisposed to this idiom, is that it's a lot like rhythm and blues, and it's a lot like rock and roll, and it's sufficiently like rock and roll. I think this is reflected on the cover of this album, too. It's very 1967, 68, Haight-Ashbury kind of art. Is you could pass this off as rock and roll, and sometimes we need to do a little shift in our minds to be able to get to that openness that we need to really appreciate is something if we're not accustomed to it. Another good tip that I've found is the Louis Armstrong Hot Fives and Sevens. Those are very early jazz. If you approach the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens as rock and roll, you're going to be driving along in the car, singing along to it, bopping along to it the way you would a Rolling Stones album from the end of the 60s type of thing. So I love that you heard Magic Sam's trademark guitar effect in those call and response fills that he was doing. That was his tremolo technique, where he's taking the note, he's taking the string, and he's reverberating it again and again and again and again. So it's just ringing. It's like a guitar version of a bell. So it does the body good to listen to Magic Sam, and this is really, I would say, that is his best album.
Now, 40 years before Magic Sam recorded that, Delta blues man by the name of Tommy Johnson recorded his first album in 1928, and what an interesting guy. I didn't know a lot about Tommy Johnson until you said we were talking about him and started diving into it a little bit. Well, the man that gave Canned Heat their name, and a guy with an incredible voice that could come at you in a whole lot of different styles.
Oh, exactly. That latter point is key. He could have that desolate, low-down voice, and he could have the even frightening falsetto. So these were sides. They weren't really albums. And he was hoodwinked into believing that he wasn't allowed to record any more than he had. He was sort of duped. He thought it was part of the fine print of his contract, so he didn't record for the rest of his life. He is one of the core Mississippi Delta male artists. Now, everyone knows, not everyone, but people into this kind of music, they know the big three, Charlie Patton, Stenhouse, and Robert Johnson. Tommy Johnson, no relation to Robert, he fits in there, and his songs are pretty intense. He's drinking all kinds of things, and these, I mean, things that like you wouldn't think are possible to drink. And it's this wild, woolly, hoochie-coochie type of music that's long on mystery and long on emotional kick. And like you said, the voice and the guitar, it's an important thing with people in the blues. I would say that the main voice, in a way, if you will, is the guitar. It's going to be the dominant instrument of the blues. And you need to be able to play the guitar at a level where the guitar sings. But when you can augment that kind of singing with something special and distinctive that you're doing with your voice that nonetheless works well in tandem with the guitar, you have the best blues musicians there are, like a Tommy Johnson.
Otis Spann is one of those interesting guys. Great piano player, came from a musical family, and a guy that seemed to constantly go back and forth on that line between the blues and rock and roll, whether it was working with people like Muddy Waters, later on with Chuck Berry, B.B. King, and one of his best is Otis Spann is the blues.
Otis Spann is like Johnny Johnson, Chuck Berry's pianist, if Johnny Johnson had been a blues artist. I feel like those two are, they run along a similar track. Otis Spann, so Johnny Johnson obviously had Chuck Berry. Otis Spann was the pianist for Muddy Waters. And really that is where he has his position in blues history. Because the early, that Muddy Waters band of the 1950s, and Spann was there right from the start, is one of those small groups. I mean, I mentioned the Hot Fives and Hot Sevens, that kind of unit. Miles Davis's second great quintet. The group that Sam Cooke had at the Harlem Square Club in 1963. It's just one of the great small ensembles in blues history and really any kind of American musical history. So Otis Spann was the bedrock of that lineup. And so he was asked to do a lot in that function with the Muddy Waters group. And I just finished saying what I did about the guitar. There are exceptions. The harmonica can be an exception. We think of Little Walter, where that's going to be the dominant voice. And we also have a pianist. We have a few others, but Otis Spann is one of the main ones. And he cut this album in 1960. He didn't feel like he had to hold back on the title. Otis Spann is the blues. No doubt about it. It's Kimball is the radio, right? I like that sort of bluesy swagger. You think it's almost going to be the sound that's all in your face, and it isn't. Otis Spann was adept at letting the music come to him, which I feel like you would have to be skilled at if you were a pianist who wasn't ostentatious. And he certainly wasn't. And he sings in a workmanlike plus kind of way, I'd say, and it's a really cool album to be into as an offshoot of the more famous stuff that he did.
All right, I have to admit, I knew next to nothing about Geeshy Wiley, but man, I wish I did, and now I need to know more, because she is absolutely fascinating. No known photographs of her exist. She only recorded a little bit. Yes, died young, 41 years old. We don't even know her real name for sure. But man, oh man, could she sing and cut right to your soul with that voice.
Well, that's why I qualified that list of Mississippi Delta musicians earlier as male, because she is the female member of the inner circle of that particular blues Hall of Fame. And I think, we think, that she also knifed and killed her husband at one point. But it didn't really seem to take, because she was out and about doing stuff. I mean, like, there's no explanation for it. It's just like, with reasonable certainty, I'm thinking, huh, how do you just get away with something like that? And Geeshy was nicknamed, and she played guitar. And she played guitar really, well. It almost sounds like this is going back. So this is going back almost a century. You wouldn't, maybe, I don't know. People think there are all these mores and men do this and women did this more than ever back then. But there are people, it certainly wasn't true in the blues, Geechee Wiley, Memphis Minnie, who we talked about in the past. Women were doing their thing. The Carter family, you have smoking female guitarist doing her thing. Geechee Wiley would start, she only had six sides. And fortunately, we have some alternates. But there's not a lot there. Well, there is and there isn't. There's not a lot in terms of, like, quantity of tracks. But what there is there is plenty. You can enjoy that and study that and get a lot out of it, revisit it frequently over the course of your entire life. I got into her really, really early. I had written this thesis when I was in college, and it was supposed to be like this highfalutin thing about vorticism, like the poetry, and Ezra Pound and music. And I just abandoned that. And I thought it was going to be about rock and roll. And then it really became about the blues without me meaning to. And I was writing about Robert Johnson and listening to Geechee Wiley and having great conversations with all my dorm mates. No, that never happened. I was the only one who knew it. But she was transfixing to me. She was one of those people with the sound. Blind Willie Johnson is a good example. Joy Division and the way that Ian Curtis would sing, where you hear it and you think, well, nothing is like. Sex Pistols is another good example. Nothing's like it. Nothing is like Geechee Wiley.
All right, from Geechee Wiley to a more modern musician, the man known as Master of the Telecaster, Albert Collins.
Albert Collins in Born Under a Bad Sign is one of those musical pairing that has that quality of, huh, why didn't I think of that? Fortunately, someone thought of it here. Well, you take a blues musician like Albert Collins, and you pair him with really the two Stax label house bands, one of them being Booker T and the MGs. That's really a renegade approach, don't you think, that you're going to have, because Stax, for people who don't know at the time, was soul. It was the ultimate soul label. And blues and soul, they were different. Stax, think of someone like Otis Redding. And for soul, think of Little Willie John, or it kind of limits Sam Cooke, but he could have his soul moments, definitely. You wouldn't think of a blues artist as like an outright candidate to record with Booker T and the MGs. And yet, someone hit upon this idea, and it was carried through to fruition. And you ended up with one of the great hybrid albums of its decade, a seamless hybrid, and one of the greatest guitar albums of all time that doesn't feature, I know you're not a huge like solo guy, it doesn't feature a lot of guitar solos. It's the playing is in the filigree, the augmentation, the Pete Townshend and The Who, especially on record, he was a lot like that. That he wouldn't solo that much. And yet, I don't think there was a better rock and roll guitarist because of the way he used his instrument as part of the architecture of that band's sound. It was very Bachian. And so you have that blues idea here with that discretionary playing of Albert Collins. And he's everyone who hears this, who had a guitar, rock fan, blues fan, both, is going to absorb what is happening on this disc.
Yeah, and you can just you picture guitar guys listening to that and going, all right, how do I try to create that sound? And I may expect it took a while for most of them.
Part of it is it's not even just the playing. I mean, obviously that's a big part of it. But it is also what you said. It's the sound. And I guess sort of a distinction is with the guitar and with rock and roll and with blues, we talk about a sound. With jazz, we talk about the same thing, different word. We talk about someone's tone. You can use them interchangeably, but people tend to be either jazz people, speaking of labels and all that, or they tend to be rock and blues. That gets confusing. Rock and blues are closely related, and yet in jazz, the very best jazz musicians, be it Lester Young, Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Billie Holiday. The thing I'd say that they're most about, or the thing that they all have in common, is the blues. They're masters of the blues. The blues is just so central. It is the horn book, if you will, of American music. It all comes back to the blues. It's built off the blues. It's our musical Dead Sea Scrolls. And so, very cool album. And you would have been like you could have been a 16-year-old kid, and you had a garage band, and you would have listened to Born Under a Bad Sign, the album, and probably covered Born Under a Bad Sign, the song. Or you could have been Cream and Eric Clapton and trying to wrap your head around this and get some reasonable facsimile with what you were doing in your approach to music.
Finally, this afternoon, one of the most unique recordings, I would guess, in any genre, from 1964, Robert Nighthawk, live, and I mean live, on Maxwell Street.
Yeah, I thought you'd like that. Have you heard this before?
I have not, no.
So did you notice things like the car horns?
Yes, I did. Absolutely. That's why I say it was like nothing you'd hear before or since.
Yeah, it was kind of like if you went into the tea and someone was playing with some buddies and you recorded it and you thought, album. So Robert Nighthawk was one of the best in blues history with slide guitar playing. That was kind of what he was, that stinging slide sound. And that sounds, people can have a slide sound, obviously, but slide sounds don't normally sting. That was kind of his thing. So his other thing was to busk. And he would go to this open air market on the west side of Chicago, and he would play on the actual street. And he was recorded playing on the street. So, I mean, really, it's like gigging at Haymarket. It's, in a way, strange. It's, talk about a field recording. Well, a field recording in the urban milieu.
Right.
When I learned about this, Kimbo, I mean, there are certain things that you learn about. Before you hear them, you're already well into them. That they would have to cock it up so badly for you not to continue to be interested after you heard the actual sound. And when I heard this sound, it was even better than I thought it was going to be. It was adventurous. It was exciting. It was a cool thing to know about. And it's not bootleg quality sound or anything like that. It came out in the late 70s, so after the fact, on a label called Rounder, which is kind of to the blues as Mosaic is. The record label is the jazz. It's like for people who are really serious about the medium. But it was thrilling to me. I just thought it was the coolest thing. And yeah, you even hear like people going by and honking the horn, and not only like tribute, but because they're pissed at other people.
Well, and I had exactly that same experience when you said we'd be talking about it. I did a little research on it and said, oh, this is going to be interesting. And then you listen and say, oh, it's beyond interesting. It's got an excitement there that I don't know that you can find on a whole lot of other live albums, because you can sense what it must have been like to just be out there on the street.
Oh, the hubbub, the chaos, the energy. Think of a painting by P.A. Mondrian when it has that frenetic quality of the urban environment. That was what it was like on the street, and these guys were I don't want to like equate them to men playing in the beer league late at night at the rink or something like that. Someone's like in a cover band and the guys get together every few months and knock it out, or a baseball player back in the day with a second job in the off season. But this would have been go time for these guys. They weren't making a lot of money, and this was their chance to do what they thought that they were most about. And it was exciting that it was Sunday for them. And someone had said once that Bill Evans and his trio, Sunday at the Village Vanguard, that it sounds like it's the Village Vanguard, and it sounds like Sunday. Well, this sounds like Maxwell Street. It sounds like an open-air market in Chicago, and it sounds like Sunday, and it sounds like these guys are well worked up to cut loose, and they do. And the guitar playing is phenomenal. This is one of the best live albums / field recordings that we have. We have to keep in mind, sort of like a very honest live album is a field recording. It's not that different than Lomax going out and ending up in a shack with Sun House and in the early 1940s and recording him there. That was live, even though there was no crowd. You can hear on those recordings the train going by and the shack rattling. I mean, honestly, it's like pure narrative that happens to also have music with it. I mean, what's better than that?
No, it's terrific. Check it out, Robert Nighthawk. Live on Maxwell Street, 1964. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. And well, speaking of live music, next week we discuss some important live rock music.
We have some good stuff. We have some recent discoveries. And what I try to do, Kimball, is strike a balance between things that people might not know about, and yet you don't want to be like hopelessly obscure with it. But you know what? I think even if we were, it would be pretty interesting, but there are some real doozies coming up for discussion next week.
Yeah, The Who, The Animals, The Stones, Zeppelin, and Dylan. That's some great live recordings. We'll talk about them all with Colin Fleming next week on Downtown. Thank you, Colin. We'll see you then.
Okay, sounds good.